from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning on Friday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said he would seek membership this week for Palestine as a state from the United Nations Security Council. What will this mean for ongoing relations with the United States, which has indicated it will veto such a proposal, and for stalled negotiations with Israel, which is opposed to the proposal? We'll hear from different sides on the issue, and then we'll hear from you. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas announced on Friday in a televised address that he plans to seek full membership for Palestine as a state this week from the Security Council of the United Nations. Presently, the Palestinian Authority holds observer status. The United States has indicated it will veto a Palestinian bid for statehood in the Security Council. And in this opening Forum hour, we focus our attention on the Palestinian bid for statehood in the UN and how it might affect the stalled Middle East peace process and the turbulent and volatile regional political landscape. Joining us in studio are a couple of local academics. Bashar Duhamani is a professor of history at University of California, Berkeley, and has been with us many times before. We welcome you back. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Also, another guest who has been with us before and is with the Hoover Institution as a senior fellow is Abraham Sofer. He served as legal advisor to the U.S. Department of State from 1985 to 1990. And welcome, Abraham Sofer.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to both of you. And let me begin, if I may, Bashar Duhamani, with you. Of course, the United States has said they would veto this because they would like to see negotiations move forward rather than what they're designating as inflated expectations and a move that would probably delegitimize Israel from their point of view. So why not move forward with negotiations? Why go this route?
Because the negotiations have failed, obviously, and the Palestinian Authority sees that it has no choice whatsoever but to break the deadlock by returning the ball to the United Nations where it has always belonged in the first place. If we think of Oslo as a way of changing the legal platform for resolving the conflict, moving it out of the international bodies and international law into a bilateral negotiations with Israel with the support and overseeing of the United States. That has been the model for the last 20 years and has led nowhere for the Palestinians. They see that every day goes by that the settlements being built by Israel, making a two-state solution impossible, has forced their hand, really, to go back to the United Nations.
Isn't this a breach of the Oslo Accords, though? It's a unilateral declaration of independence?
It's not a unilateral declaration of independence. In fact, over 100 countries have already recognized the state of Palestine since 1988, including several important Latin American countries just in the last year, such as Brazil. And also recently, France, England, Italy, Spain, and others upgraded the missions of the Palestinian delegation to that of embassies. So that movement has been going on for a while. And if you look at the speeches by Bush II and by Obama as well as the quartet, they all said that a Palestinian state could be declared before the end of negotiations. So what the Palestinian Authority is asking for is really what the international community and the U.S. said they want to deliver all along but haven't been able to.
And in fact, Abraham Sofer, a recent poll the BBC published from 19 countries says that about 44% of the people, this is just the public, are in favor of a Palestinian state, about 21% opposed. Of course, that's 90% in Egypt. But you call this a big distraction. And why not move forward in this way? Because the negotiations don't seem to have been, as Professor Duhamani said, moving anywhere.
I think the negotiations aren't moving anywhere. I agree. And I don't underestimate the value of the UN. If in the right context, we haven't seen the resolution that is being proposed. But if it all it does is say a Palestinian state is hereby created with the 1967 borders, it could create more trouble than help.
What would the nature of that trouble be as you see it?
Well, I think that you raise expectations locally about, you know, among the Palestinian people again, as Camp David did. It could, in the long run, and even in the short run, could create a crisis there for Abbas. However, I want to say that I think we have overplayed this issue. We have made too big a deal out of the mere fact that he wants to go to the UN and seek a declaration of statehood, because I don't think Abbas has any choice. He is running out of funds. He's been an illegitimate governor for quite a while, in the sense that he was supposed to call elections and didn't. Half of his country is controlled by Hamas, so he's not in a position to deliver anything on the Palestinian side. So he is really in a desperate situation, and we should have been more understanding, since he is clearly the preferable party for us and Israel to negotiate with. And I think that it would be better if we were approaching this, we the United States were approaching this with less of a threatening attitude and more of a cooperative attitude, and with maybe a willingness even to look at the UN process as a vehicle for moving the thing forward rather than creating more of a problem.
Well, Mahmoud Abbas said that he may actually shift gears and go to the General Assembly, but if he does go to the Security Council, as he said he would on Friday, and the United States vetoes that, you're talking about trouble. I mean, the Israeli embassy was essentially sacked in Cairo, and this would, if anything, probably exacerbate anger against Israel throughout the Arab world. In fact, even from those who have been somewhat friendly toward Israel. It's already, in fact, fait accompli that Turkey is hurt its relations, or has diplomatic relations between Turkey and Israel have been hurt and injured quite seriously.
Well, not because of Israel's fault. I mean, if Turkey has its aspirations now that are very different than the ones they had before when they were friendly with Israel. But I do agree with you. It's certainly going to hurt Israel's standing in the world and in the Middle East, as well as the Americas. And from the point of view of an American, I'm concerned, who loves Israel and supports Israel, I'm concerned about the U.S. taking the role of doing just merely vetoing this. And because in the next term, it may well be that the administration will greatly resent having had to do this at a time when they want to reach out and get support in the Arab world, and have the Arabs see the U.S. as supporting democratization and the Arab Spring, as they call it. So, yes, I agree with you. But the solution is not to say we're not going to veto, because if we have a crude resolution that doesn't really do anything to advance the process and creates expectations that are not deliverable, then it will be a very negative thing. However, if the U.S., instead of trying to negotiate Abbas into not going to the U.N., I think he's going to go to the U.N. one way or the other. If the U.S.
There's been tremendous pressure on him, of course, not to, including financial pressure.
Right.
And the threat of withdrawing U.S. money and so forth.
Right. Well, I would not take that approach. I think the U.S. should be going to him and telling him, look, what are you in the position to agree to? We support a Palestinian state. The U.S. supports a Palestinian state. And what are the terms that we would include in a resolution that would enable us to vote for it? And I think we need to put those on the table, because we need to make it clear to the world that we are for a Palestinian state, and that it's the Palestinians that are unprepared to accept the conditions, the absolutely necessary preconditions to having a Palestinian state.
Let me go back to Bashir Dumani on that point, but also on the sense that we get that there is this division in Palestine between, obviously, Gaza and the West Bank, between Hamas and between the Palestinian Authority. And how can, say, Mahmoud Abbas justifiably represent both sides when there was an agreement worked out by Cairo, but there clearly is a lot of contention and a lot of division between the two?
Well, the Palestinians won't be able to deliver on anything unless they speak with one voice. And so coordination between Hamas and Fatah as the two major movements within the Palestinian national body politic is absolutely essential to any movement forward. Unfortunately, not only do they have their differences, but the United States and Israel have made it a precondition that they will not talk with the PA if it agrees with Hamas to form a national unity government. So they're basically saying that we can't talk to you because you can't deliver, but you can't deliver because we won't accept you having a national unity government with Hamas. So it's a catch-22 situation, and it's precisely because they've been stuck in this catch-22 situation that the Palestinian Authority feels that they have no choice but to go to the United Nations. Now, they've made their intention to go to the United Nations clear long before they prepared for such a move.
What about Judge Sofer's point, though, that the United States does recognize a Palestinian state or the necessity for a Palestinian state?
And then what? And do what? They've done nothing for 20 years while the West Bank's demography, topography, and future is being decided through a one-way street by Israeli actions as the dominant power in the region, economically, politically, militarily, etc. So the United States has not been a neutral player in this. Nobody would like the United States more than myself to be a neutral player in this, but they haven't been. And the United States doesn't have much of a ground to say, leave this issue to us, not to the United Nations. You know, Israel and Palestine were both formed by the United Nations in Resolution 181, then you have Resolution 194 and 67, Resolution 242. That's always been the place for resolving this issue.
In fact, Israel was formed out of the United Nations.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you need to stress that. You know, we've created a sense of panic over the process in the UN as though the UN is something that can't be used to advance the process of peace and security in the world. We've got the 47 partition resolution, the 49 creation of Israel as a member, the 67-242, which is, of course, the governing resolution that after 93, even the PA agrees should govern the process. And in 73, the 338 resolution adopting the 242. So, I mean, there is nothing wrong with going to the Security Council. People should stop getting so excited about that and start thinking about what can be done there to show the world where the differences are.
Well, there are doves in Israel, for example, who are saying that Abbas is just asking for a right of return. He's not asking for a right of return. He's not asking for ownership of the Temple of the Mount. He just wants recognition to the going back to the borders of 67.
Well, you know, in a year or two ago, as late as that, people would have seen this move as being a pro-Israeli move in the sense that he's saying, I'm going to the United Nations to ask for everything that Israel has asked me to accept. But under this current Israeli government and in a climate in the United States where you're in perpetual election mode, where the pro-Israel lobby really has a lock on U.S. foreign policy on this issue, then suddenly it becomes like a radical move. And the panic button is being pressed by the New York Times on a regular basis. But there is some reason to believe that...
Actually, not only the New York Times, the International Crisis Group blames Palestinian leaders for overselling what they can achieve by this. But they also blame Israel for essentially overvaluating the impact of UN recognition and thinking that it will somehow retaliate against the Palestinians.
Well, you know, it won't change the power relations on the ground. But there will be some advantages if, and it's not going to happen, Palestine becomes recognized as a state as a result of getting 9 votes or more from the Security Council without a U.S. veto. That's not going to happen. But if it does happen, then the Palestinians can say that the occupation is illegal, that it's a breach of Palestinian sovereignty.
They can go to the International
They can
court.
Go to the International Court of
Criminal
Justice.
Court.
In criminal court, they can propose resolutions, they can join UN bodies, they can have diplomatic immunity in other countries. Their security forces would become an army, not terrorists. I mean, it's a big psychological shift, really, of the whole legal grounds for the conflict. That's assuming there's no U.S. veto, but we know that there will be. So the second level of being, instead of being a member state, to be an observer state, like Taiwan, for example, would require two-thirds off the General
Nine
Assembly.
Of the 15 votes.
Yes, and if they
no,
get...
No, two-thirds of the Assembly, the General Assembly.
No, I'm talking about recognitions for the Security Council would be
right.
nine
of 15. But it, yeah. it almost fait accompli, isn't it,
yes.
that the General Assembly would back it? Would we both agree? Would you both
yeah,
agree?
I
yeah,
think
yeah,
that's
it's
probably
not,
right.
It's,
yeah.
not, it's not going to happen.
I agree that I agree that it's a mistake for Abbas to do this in terms of the interests of the Palestinian people. But as I said, I just don't think he has any option. And we should be dealing with this as a reality that has been long time in coming and that we should be preparing for. And there should be – of course, there is no resolution out there yet. And you have to think about this practically. You can't just think of it as in the abstract. What is it going to say? And what amendments are going to be put forward? What kinds of discussions are going to occur?
Well, it's not exactly a resolution. It's an application. So, and the question is,
isn't it
right.
what happened with Southern Sudan, for example, would be follow that paradigm?
Yes, except that in that case, everybody was agreed what's going to happen before the application was submitted. In this particular case, rules and words do have a great role to play. The United States can say we need to study the application. We need to think about the words of the application. We need to submit some amendments to the application. We're going to hold it for weeks unless you change your position. Maybe meanwhile we'll cut off the $1.5 billion in funds that you get to pay your 170,000 civil servants, and et cetera, et cetera. This could drag on for a while, but every day it drags on. The United States looks like the bad guy in this whole thing.
Mashar Dumani is professor of history at University of California, Berkeley, and Abraham Sofer is a senior fellow with the Hoover Institution. What about the argument? Well, Daniel Ayalon, the deputy foreign minister of Israel, says that using that example of southern Sudan, there's been a failure of the Palestinian Authority to reach the standards of sovereignty. It hasn't established its borders. It hasn't renounced terrorism or proven itself a peace lover. I mean, these are all supposedly part of the criteria or touchstones to meeting those standards. I see you smiling, Professor Dumani, because you're thinking necessarily Israel hasn't either, I would guess. I don't want to say like I'm reading your mind.
Yeah.
But that's the argument that, in other words, economically it hasn't become really part of the international community. And in fact, the argument, I guess, on your side of things, Judge Silvera, is economic support for Palestine so that they can become the sovereign state, right?
But those are the legal requirements for statehood, and they have always been there. You're supposed to control your foreign policy, your borders, and a population. And Palestine doesn't meet those criteria, but everyone recognizes in the real world that if you go to the Security Council and nine members vote and there's no veto, you're a state. You're a member state. So yes, it's important to remember where they are in the process. They're certainly further down the road, I think, in many ways than they were, thanks to Fayyad and others. In the final analysis, it doesn't matter. You're going to have a political vote.
I'm going to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join this conversation. In fact, we welcome your questions or comments, and you can call us now at our toll-free number and participate in the program and become involved in it. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls and would like to hear from you. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas expected to petition the United Nations Security Council for full membership, although he has stated, and he stated as recently as today, that that's the plan for now, but suggested that he might change tactics at the last minute and actually go for the lesser option of the General Assembly approval of the Palestinians as a non-member observer state. Chances for success, as we've indicated, are much higher in the General Assembly, which he is to address. And I wonder if we go back to the whole idea of 1967 and the borders of 1967, and President Obama has said publicly that's what he wants, isn't it?
That's exactly right, Michael. And it's one of the main points. What are the borders going to be? Now, he's also said, though, that the parties have to talk about adjustments that are necessary for a lasting peace. And so that would be one of the things that we ought to put into a counter-resolution, if you will, that says, okay, you say the 67 borders, but we agree in principle you start with the 67 borders. Pretty much everyone agrees with that. But then you have to talk about necessary adjustments. And instead of being just blindly and absolutely vetoing this kind of a resolution, that is one of the three things that I would propose the U.S. to add to the Palestinian resolution to make it clear to the world that we are not saying no to Palestine. And it's imperative that we make that clear in this process.
Well, since you're speaking of three options, Bashar Damani, I noticed that Abdel Shat, the Palestinian Authority official, said we have three options. We can either surrender, we can go to violence, or we can go this route. You would agree with that?
Yes, I would agree that from their perspective, Nabil Shat has been a long-time negotiator on the Palestinian Authority and strong contact with the United States. So he's basically telling everybody, you pushed us to the corner, you've failed to deliver on anything, and now we have no choice because we either, that is to say the Palestinian Authority, lose all credibility with our own people, or we get rejected by the United States as a partner. Either way, we have no choice but to go back to the United Nations. Let me just say that for the Palestinians and many others, there's strong debate about this issue. There's not unanimous Palestinian support for this move, precisely for the reasons I think that Abe has been saying, which is that many are afraid that what this will do is relegate the right of the Palestinians to return, relegate the issue of the borders of 67 or even the possibility of a one-state democratic state, the question of Jerusalem. All of these things will be given up in pursuit of statehood that has no real substance in terms of actual things on the ground because they don't control their water supply, their electricity, their borders, their airspace, or anything. Israel controls all of that, and Israel has controlled the economy of this region since 1967 completely. So why give up all these things in return for no real change on the ground? So the question for many Palestinians is, what exactly is the intention behind this move? Are they prepared for it? It seems to me that they are not really prepared for carrying out such a move.
Could you say almost categorically that Mahmoud Abbas, I mean, you suggest his back is against the wall and he really seemed to feel there was no other option, but he also wanted to stop the settlements and was unable to do that. President Obama was unable to deliver from his perspective, right? And because of that and because of the fact that the peace negotiations aren't moving forward, And the Arab Spring, this is his move now.
Well, you know, there could be an Arab Spring against the Palestinian Authority unless he moves.
That's what I mean. That's
exactly
what I mean. Yeah.
Absolutely. The world has changed. The Middle East has changed. The United States and Israel still seem to be in denial in all of this. You mentioned Turkey and Egypt being the cornerstones of
Ehud Barak said there is a diplomatic tsunami coming.
Right, that's the right, way he put right. It. And the reaction to that seems to be, we're not budging for the United States and Israel. And that is not a good position to be in at all.
Well, you don't want to budge on things that really matter. But on the other hand, you don't want to get rigid and look like you are opposed to what you favor.
When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. We're also going to talk with Augustus Richard Norton, a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University, who has, well, a different take on this. We're talking here on Forum about the Palestinian bid to achieve UN membership. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the Palestinian bid for statehood, which will occur this week in the United Nations, talking with Bashar Damani, professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, and Abraham Sofer, who is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and who also served as legal advisor to the U.S. Department of State, 85 to 90. I wanted to Judge Sofer, I know you wanted to say something in response to just the lack of preparedness that Professor Damani mentioned about the Palestinians.
Yes, I agree with him, because assuming we did make a move to amend the resolution to say
we being the United States,
we the United States, the 67 borders as amended by agreement of the parties in order to create a secure border. We would then have the problem of how do you implement this 1967 borders as amended? How do you do it? Who goes first? When does it happen? Right now, nothing changes on the ground. Frustration grows enormously. And this is the kind of thing, the danger in this kind of a resolution.
Well, it winds up back at the United Nations, doesn't it?
Well, no.
At least in part.
I think a resolution could include mechanisms for the implementation of the 67 borders as amended. It could start with each party putting its position on the borders on the table in the Security Council. Within a certain period, we know that the differences were relatively negligible at Camp David II. Are the parties going to act in good faith or bad faith?
Yeah, but this is all assuming that the 67 occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem is the real issue. It's part of the real issue, but it's not the full issue. The Palestinians as a people also have other concerns besides the borders. One being Jerusalem. The other one being the question of refugees and their right to return. And we must not forget the 20% of Israel's population who are Palestinians, who are calling for equal rights.
Of course, if you get Palestinian statehood, it's no longer disputed territory. It's occupied territory, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this way, that if they get member status, then they can say that this is a breach of sovereignty.
Which, of course, from Israel's point of view, is delegitimizing Israel's borders presently.
Absolutely. So
but the border issue is the Jerusalem issue in part.
Yes, of course.
And the third issue, the one that Bashar raises, the issue of the rights of residents of the new Palestine and the existing Israel, is the third issue that has to be addressed in this resolution. And that would reflect the position of the United States on these issues. And what is our position? Our position is that neither of these countries should be racist. The Palestinians should not be making statements about how they're going to have Judenrein, no Jews in Palestine. And the Israelis, of course, have always made it clear that Arab citizens of Israel are free to stay.
Just apropos of that, in fact, here are sort of two sides in emails. A listener named Roberta writes, I want to point out that Abbas has stated over and over that no Jews will be allowed to live in Palestine, as well as no homosexuals. The Hamas charter openly states that they are dedicated to the destruction of Israel. How can Israel make peace with an entity who wants to obliterate it? And then another listener, Haitham, writes, why was it okay for Israel to pursue the same course through the UN, and now it is not okay for the Palestinians to do so? There you see, seems to me, sort of the two sides of the spectrum. But let me get our callers involved in this. And sure. First caller is Lemoyne. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Very briefly, as an uninvolved and observer of all of this, it seems to me that the underlying issue, which is going to determine everything, is in fact the settlements. And I don't see how you can understand the settlement activity other than an attempt to annex the West Bank. There was an Israeli soldier on the radio over the weekend that talked about the fact that the Israeli military policies in the West Bank are not designed in a defensive posture, or are not designed to defend borders, but rather to disrupt daily life in order to impose upon people a feeling of occupation. So it seems to me that, you know, the Israelis can argue that, you know, they're being attacked and so forth, and they will retaliate militarily when they are attacked, no question. But the settlement activity, it seems to me, at the end of the day, is a designed, deliberate strategy to annex. It amounts to a ethnic cleansing, and I don't think that with settlements there can be any peace, irrespective of anything else.
All right. Let me actually bring in, as I said before the break, Professor Augustus Richard Norton, who's professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University, and joins us this morning as well. Professor Norton, good to have you. Welcome.
Yes, it's nice to join you. I'm sorry to join you midway, but I had some other obligations. But it's nice to be with you and your guest. Look, I think there are a couple of realities here. It's obviously true that there are many details to be worked out, as both your other guests have indicated. But the reality is that nothing is happening. When the Obama administration came into office, there were chimerical claims that Netanyahu was a real peacemaker and so on. This is patently not true. What we've seen is the Israeli government has really been unwilling to engage in a process of building a two-state solution in any kind of serious way, and other than rhetorical flourishes to the contrary. We have an Obama administration that has made promises, but really has backed off its position. You now have somebody in the White House, Dennis Ross, who's the administration point man on these issues, who really, if you think about this in baseball terms, he's a guy who strikes out all the time, seldom gets a double or triple or a home run. Every once in a while might eke out a single. He's been a failure as a peacemaker in the Bush administration, in the prior Clinton administration, and now in the Obama administration.
Chris, we've had Dennis Ross. Excuse me, Professor Norton, I just have to speak up because we've had Dennis Ross on this program, and of course he's written a book about the failure that you mentioned and said the failure was less his and more Chairman Arafat's not signing into agreement what was put in front of him. But I don't want to necessarily go into all that. I was more curious to get your response to the last call about the Israelis trying to essentially annex the West Bank and that caller's position that the settlements are really at the heart of this.
Well, the settlements are clearly at the heart of this. And clearly you have, on the one hand, an Israeli regime that's intent on continuing to colonize the West Bank and retain most of the key territory, to leave bits and parts of the territory to the Palestinians, which means that the Palestinians would not end up with a contiguous viable state. Now, we need to find some way of moving from that reality to a new reality where there's some kind of feasible forward movement possible. The U.S. now finds itself very, very isolated in its relationship with Israel. To the extent that this initiative at the UN highlights that isolation, that may indeed be therapeutic in terms of helping Washington to understand that its interest in Israel's are in some ways quite different. And we need to see, if you will, a real shift in the U.S. position in order to make that two-state solution a reality.
Well, let me get you on record here, because you've, I think, taken the position that the United States can and should abstain from using its veto.
Yes, I think that would be a very appropriate step. I don't think it should be done this coming week. Obviously, what's going to happen is that Abbas is going to make a presentation to the Security Council. At that point, the issue will be tabled for discussion and study. It should be a matter of negotiation on the part of the U.S. to basically set the terms of reference for that abstention. That requires movement on both the part of the Palestinians and the part of the Israelis. I expect that process is going to take weeks, if not months. But for the U.S. to veto this initiative only further corroborates the isolation of the U.S. in a time of great danger for U.S. interests in the Middle East. And we need to put U.S. interests foremost, not the interest of any other state.
Again, Augustus Richard Norton is professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. And Lenny is our next caller from Berkeley. Lenny, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, I'm on the air?
Yes, sir, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I really am quite amazed. I think we have a word in the United Kingdom, gobsmacked. It just seems to me a singular diatribe directed at Israel with no real Israeli representation at all in terms of the complexity of the situation, and really I'm quite amazed. What I'd like to say is that Israel's predicament is that it's really surrounded on all sides by enemies who are aggressively committed to its destruction. And many of our friends, I call myself an Israeli in that respect, aren't actually committed to Israel's security, nor do many people say, to my mind at least, that the Palestinian Authority is a terrorist group. And Abbas himself, his term of office has expired more than 2 years ago. He hasn't actually earned the moral right to lead this negotiation towards Palestinian statehood. None of us in Israel are actually against the idea of Palestinian statehood whatsoever. It's how you negotiate that. And I hear you talking about going back to 67 borders. Those borders, everybody on the planet knows, are indefensible, for goodness sake. I mean, where is a balanced discussion as to Israel's position, its psyche, the overwhelming experience of its people, where Israel has actually retracted? They left Gaza, every inch of it. They offered statehood in 2000. They offered statehood in 2008.
Lenny, I'm going to have to break in here because Abe Sofer is on record as saying he loves Israel, and I think the gentleman is indicting you for being in favor of 67 borders. So,
well, I don't know if he's indicting me, but I mean, I agree that Israel has shown that it can withdraw from Sinai and Gaza and take down settlements for peace. So I think the statement that settlements or the whole situation is absurd. But
what about the gentleman's statement that going back to those borders would put Israel in a very precarious and insecure situation?
Well, some parts of the borders are indefensible, but not most of them. Most of the 67 borders, Israel, I think, could readily agree to and has readily agreed to. So the question is, on those parts that are indefensible, the parties have to negotiate. We know that. And the U.S. should modify any resolution that's put on the table to say the 67 borders have to be renegotiated to the extent that they are indefensible. And on the issue of the right of return, when you create two states, clearly the Palestinians should return to the Palestine, and that would necessarily be part of the U.S. position in voting on a resolution. And if the Palestinians accepted these very fundamental and difficult choices for them, that would create the potential of a secure Israel, it would seem to me then that the U.S. ought to work very hard with Israel to get them to accept it. And if the Palestinians don't accept it, Michael, then what it does show, at least, is it shows the record of U.S. support for Palestine on certain conditions that make sense. Everyone recognizes these make sense and are absolutely necessary for a future that's stable and peaceful.
Let me go to a couple of comments from our Facebook. This is Jennifer, who says, talking about Israel is radioactive, so I tread lightly, but after all the years of the U.S. talking about and working on a two-state solution, I wish there was a way we could simply support the Palestinian effort in the United Nations. I'm not sure what Mr. Obama has to lose, since he is already, for some unknown reason, perceived as anti-Israel and has been treated so disrespectfully by Mr. Netanyahu. Another Facebook comment from Ramin. Whether you think of the Palestinian United Nations bid as a ploy or not, this issue would have to be addressed. Because of the ever-increasing population density there, we have to consider how these two nations can occupy the same geographic area and at the same time maintain their national characteristics as much as possible. Perhaps a good resolution by the United Nations would be to ensure the rights of both these nations within the same geographic area. In other words, two nations in the space of one. Lee is our next caller. Lee, you're on. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Please forgive this very simpleton perspective and perhaps even ignorant, but for those of us who are non-Jewish and non-Palestinian, and aren't learned in the struggles and the situation, can you briefly explain to me why is the U.S. so involved? Why do we need so much effort? Why do we have to use so much of our resources? Couldn't we just let the two parties work it out themselves? Whatever happens, happens. Again, I don't wish any harm on anybody, but it just seems to me that we are so involved, and I don't quite understand why. And again, sorry about the simpleton perspective.
Well, no, it's not a simpleton perspective. It's a complicated answer and one that deserves probably a whole program in itself. But, you know, there are a lot of United States interests in the Middle East, to put it mildly, not only with oil, but with stability. And there's also, of course, lobbies. The Israeli lobby is a very powerful and strong lobby and has a good deal of impact on United States politics and relations with countries in the Middle East. And the United States, as I said, I think, you know, rather than go into a whole debate about this, I'm just trying to give an overview because I think both answers are usually offered: security, geopolitical positioning, and also the reality of politics. But Bashar Dumani, you had a response before to Abe Sofer.
Well, it has to do with this sort of focus on statehood on 67 and on the borders that I don't think is helpful, because there are fundamental issues that are involved here that don't just relate to what the U.S. wants or what Israel wants. It has to do with what is possible and fair and moral, because The question of Palestine and the Palestinians has been the litmus test for the United States in terms of double standards. It can't possibly be calling for democracy and justice and equality before the law and yet support a vision of a state that excludes a good part of its citizens. So the question of a Jewish state, for example, which the U.S. seems to be making a condition in the latest meeting between Dennis Ross and Abbas on this issue, put on the table, you recognize Israel as a Jewish state, and then we can move on, which was not a condition before, but it's become a condition. It's basically saying that the U.S. and with a black president supports the another country calling itself a white country or a Protestant country to the exclusion of all its other citizens. So the United States has a lot more at stake than just oil and just geostrategic stability. It has at stake its character, its moral character, and its credibility in the world. And the world is changing.
But Arab citizens are full citizens in Israel. I mean,
they're not. They're,
I mean, they have the vote. They have enfranchisement. They are representing the Knesset and so forth. And I ought to mention, by the way, excuse me, just one other thing that I didn't mention in response to that last caller, which is that there's also the argument that one hears frequently: Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. It has a special relationship with the United States, etc. I'm sure you've heard that many times.
Well, yeah, well, we've heard these things many times, but the Israelis themselves are very concerned about the direction of their own government, with the anti-boycott law, with the redefinition of citizenship, with the question. There's a whole range of legal changes that have taken place in Israel just in the last few years that has everybody calling, well, everybody who considers themselves liberal in Israel, calling for the world to help them deal with the direction his government seems to be going. And in the case of the United States, its duplicity in this matter takes on a special relevance when you see the entire region changing. Before, it was easy. We support Israel and we want oil and we can deal with it because Egypt's on our side and Turkey's on our side and all these regimes will stamp out the will of their own people in support of the U.S. position. But that is no longer tenable. And for the United States to look for the future, it needs to own back its own policy for the Middle East. It can't just have that policy sort of subcontracted to the pro-Israel lobby in this country.
I want to hear from you on this, Professor Norton. Get a response from you?
Well, I quite agree with the viewpoint that was just expressed. And I will say also that while it's technically true, as you've observed, that Arab citizens of Israel do technically have the same rights as Jewish citizens, in practice, those rights have been quite truncated. When you look at the level of funding for Arab communities in Israel versus the level of funding per capita for Jewish communities, you see great disparities. Recently, efforts have been made to sort of de-Arabize even roadsides in Israel, despite the fact that Arabic is supposed to be a co-equal language within Israel. So I don't think we should get too wrapped up in these sort of talking points about Israel being the only true democracy. I think that's obviously very arguable at this point, given the developments that are taking place in the region. And we need to be deeply conscious of the fact that on the part of public opinion in places like Tunisia and Egypt and Jordan, these are issues that very much motivate people to protest, to engage in politics, and so on. And we can't ignore that. We could ignore it during a time when dictators were in charge in Egypt and Tunisia. We can't ignore it any longer. And that needs to be as much a calculation in the formulation of U.S. policy as the domestic concerns that may be elicited by taking one or another stance vis-a-vis Israel.
All right. Let me bring another caller in. Amir, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to talk a little bit. I'm originally from Egypt, and from what I've been seeing in the past couple of years since Obama took presidency here in the U.S. is that the U.S. has built a lot of political capital, at least on the streets of Egypt, both through the Obama speech that he gave at Cairo University, in which he addressed the people at the beginning, say, Salaam Alaikum, and also during the support of the Arab uprising, a lot of Egyptians appreciate the political pressure that Obama put both on the military and on the former president of Egypt to resign. So So during the last couple of months, the U.S. has definitely built a lot of political capital in the region. And during a lot of the anti-Israeli demonstrations that take place on Israeli on the streets of Cairo, usually you would find the American flag being burned in tandem with the Israeli flag. This has not been the case during the last demonstrations that happened in front of the Israeli embassy in Cairo. So I think one of the moves of the Palestinians, of Mahmoud Abbas, to go to the UN is definitely to expose and put the U.S. and President Obama in a corner and kind of expose and risk this political capital that he has built over the last couple of years on the Arab street in general, on in the Egyptian street as well in particular. So I don't know if the audience agrees with this as well or not.
Well, I don't know how to do a poll on the audience, but I thank you for your comments, and I want to remind the audience that you are listening to Forum. We're talking with Bashir Dumani from UC Berkeley and Abraham Sofer from the Hoover Institution and Augustus Richard Norton from Boston University. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to Jerry next. Jerry, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Michael. I just wanted to make a comment regarding the religious belief that seems to be ignored so much in the conversation. I mean, the firm belief of the Israeli right, along with the Christian right, is that the land of Israel must encompass all of the lands of the ancient kingdom. And that's one of the reasons for settlements, of course. The other side of the equation, of course, is that there should be a caliphate, and is it the existence of Israel is a thorn in the side of those Islamist fundamentalists who believe Israel shouldn't exist at all. So I'd appreciate it if your guest would make some comment on the possibility of addressing those issues, which seem to be the most fundamental ones that prevent any peace from occurring.
Well, let's hear from you on this, Bashir Dumani. How much does religion, especially given, again, Hamas is fairly strong on its Islamic ideology, how much does it play in this?
Well, if you... I think religion is very important, has always been very important in this, but the way it's expressed itself and the meanings that it's had has changed over time. If you look at absolute financial resources, power, and institutions behind any religious movement, then you would find out, I think, that the United States and Israel have the two largest and most fundamentalist religious movements practically in the world today. If you think about the core voting bloc behind Bush Jr., and if you think about the religious movement in Israel and the amount of resources and power and their positions in the military and intelligence services, when you put all that together and their positions on absolute denial of the right of the Palestinians to any part of Palestine, and that the Messiah will not come unless it's completely Judaized, and then, of course, for the Christians, Armageddon and all the Jews will be killed except 144,000 of them, and then they also have to be converted to Christianity. I mean, when you think about how many millions of people in the U.S. believe that, and the kind of political and economic power that they have, then I think that if we want to talk fundamentalisms, really the United States and Israel are the two biggest problems in this respect. Hamas can talk all at once about the religion and politics, but in fact it's a two-bit player compared to these two giants. Having said that, I think we can have an intelligent conversation with folks who look at religion as part of politics and use religious vocabulary as part of a political vocabulary, and to say to them or accept what they've been saying all along, which is this is a legitimate way, as far as they're concerned, to talk about politics and should not be dismissed out of hand. And the more space they have on the political table to play by the rules of democracy, the better it is for everybody.
Abe Sofer, want to put it in?
Well, I think it's a big distraction to say that religion is what's causing this. Of course, you have crazy people like the religious guy who killed Rabin, a Jew. So you have people on both sides who want to destroy, who are carried away by their belief. But the fundamental question is the great majority of each side willing to make the compromises necessary to live in peace together? And I think the answer to that is yes. At least certainly that's true of Israel. Now, on the other side, the U.S. has to assume the answer is yes and has to always show that it is prepared to take the positions that are fair and just with regard to both sides. And so I think it's very important that we not be seen as naysayers here. And that's my basic point about this whole effort. We can't just go to Abbas and say, please don't go to the Security Council or we'll threaten you with this or we'll give you this. And they start making lists of things like you have to agree to a Jewish state. I mean, Israel is a Jewish state. It doesn't need the Palestinians or anyone else to say it is a Jewish state. So introducing that is really a way of trying to get some leverage with the return issue, the right of return issue. Because you can't have a Jewish state if you allow 3 million, let's say, non-Jewish Arabs into Israel. But the way to deal with that is straightforwardly. Palestine and let the Palestinian refugees return to that Palestine.
We've just got seconds left. I want a final word from you, Professor Norton.
Well, I think the views that were just expressed are views that make a lot of sense, which is to say the U.S. needs to be seen here as a partner for peace for both sides. And the risk is that it will take a stance that will not do that, but will isolate the U.S. from its interest in the region and profoundly undermine Israel's security in the process, it seems to me.
That's going to be the final word. Thank you, Augustus Richard Norton. Thank you, Abraham Sofer. Thank you, Bashar Dumani. And thank you, our listeners. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Annie Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.